On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Podcast Magazine takes readers into the lives of today's leading podcasters and beyond the microphone of the shows fans love. Each month, Podcast Magazine's dedicated writers share personal interviews, exclusive categorical charts, industry happenings, and more. This month's issue features a special sit-down with Teray, who shares how to unlock the doors to success and find purpose in life and career. Get a free lifetime subscription while you can at podcastmagazine.com.
In the age of coronavirus, we've talked a lot about the hero doctors and nurses who are on the front lines fighting this battle. But this week, I want to focus on another sort of essential worker on the front lines of the corona fight, the New York City police officer. If New York is the epicenter, then Brooklyn and Queens are the epicenter of the epicenter, dealing with more cases per capita than any other borough. And the officers patrolling Brooklyn and Queens can't practice social distancing. My friend, Lieutenant Edwin Raymond, says on a normal week, he sees about 3 dead bodies. But suddenly, in the era of corona, it's upwards of 9 or 10 or more. And lots of cops are getting it. And lots more cops are calling out sick. Should they, right now, be arresting people for petty crimes and bringing them to jails where the chance of getting corona is high? Should they be arresting people for not practicing social distancing and then bringing them to jails like Rikers where they're risking getting corona? Should they be over-policing Black neighborhoods as they normally do? I'm asking Lieutenant Raymond all of that because he's a unique officer who's been battling the force from within the force for years, demanding they not use quotas and treat Black and brown citizens more fairly. It's a tough battle, and he's going to have to watch his back for the rest of his life, but he believes it's worth it. Of course, this is the Patreon era of Toray Show, so if you want to hear the second half of this amazing interview and get our Friday exclusives, please subscribe at patreon.com/Toray Show. That's patreon.com/Toray Show. And for just $5 a month, you'll get all these episodes, 2 a week, and you'll be helping our team. Now, it's Lieutenant Edwin Raymond, NYPD, Brooklyn, on Toray Show.
Lieutenant, how many dead bodies have you seen in the last week or two versus how many do you normally see when you're out patrolling?
So it's been about 15 in less than 2 weeks. And normally in less than 2 weeks, it might be one. You know, that's how much of a difference it's been since this thing has hit. And colleagues who I speak to in other precincts, they have seen an exponential increase also. One precinct, 19 in 48 hours. A precinct yesterday, 8 in just the morning shift. Another precinct, 20 in 7 days. This is, we've never seen anything like this before.
What are other ways that you, because you're on the front lines of dealing with this while the rest of us are at home trying to stay safe. What are other ways that you have seen the impact of corona in your day-to-day work?
Some people who have other conditions are avoiding the hospital in a way of trying to avoid corona. And then they end up, you know, unfortunately passing away because they didn't get the medical help that they needed. So this thing is, it's creating a web of issues.
Mm. I'm noticing a lot of statistics coming out just even today and yesterday, noticing Black and brown people are dying from this more. And we're seeing statistics in Michigan and Wisconsin and Illinois reflecting that. Not because the virus discriminates. Of course, the virus does not know a Black body from a brown body. But health conditions, class conditions, our relationship to hospitals and doctors because of historic conditions. Those things play in and leave Black bodies and brown bodies more vulnerable to this, and that is having an impact on outcomes. Are you seeing that in your work?
Absolutely. I mean, that's inherent racism, definition right there. Also, many of the essential workers who are still out there, 75% of them are Black and brown folks. So people who are out there, just more in a position that more susceptible to contracting this happen to be Black and brown folks. In the New York City Police Department, so far we've lost 8 employees, all of them Black. Same thing in the transit, MTA, the transit, the subway system, they've all been Black. And so, yeah, this is my experience. This is what I'm witnessing.
I mean, it's having a huge impact on the police department, is it not? I saw some statistics that said the NYPD infection rate is 4% versus the city as a whole is 0.5%. I mean, I spoke to a supervisor the other day who said 1 in 4 from the 88th precinct, 1 in 4 of his officers are being infected. So what are you seeing inside the force?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, first responders can't practice social distancing. We wouldn't be able to get our jobs done if we could. And I believe that that's a direct reflection of that reality. If something goes on, I got to take police action. I have to be out there to educate the people. I have to be out there to let the people to ask the people if they can go inside. I find a lot of people walking to and from the train stations. And when I ask them, what are they doing? They just happen to go for a train ride, going to check some friends. And, unfortunately, the people are not taking this serious enough. This is what I've been finding. So as a police officer, having to be out there, it's inevitable. We're more susceptible to this thing.
Do you think that some Black people who may be historically skeptical of the news are not taking this as seriously and are kind of going about their thing as normal and making themselves more vulnerable?
That's one of the things that I'm finding. Some people, they say, I don't trust the media, et cetera. Others, I've actually found people that say, I thought Black people can't get this. Unfortunately, people are not educated enough about how detrimental this thing is. But yeah, definitely the historical, cynicism that exists between certain communities and in the medical field, that exacerbates the issue also.
And you've seen some business owners, even as we talked the other day, some business owners trying to slide around. Tell me about the restaurant that tried to pretend it was closed.
Yeah, it was a restaurant in Queens where the front gate remained closed as if the business itself was closed, but they had a side entrance and they had full dining, waiters, everything, as if we didn't have a social distancing going on. Thankfully, the state liquor authority pulled their license and they're probably going to lose their entire business now because, you go from being able to sell alcohol to not, that's going to hurt you. That's going to hurt profits.
But that's what you risk. I mean, what else can we expect? We've seen a small number of people be arrested for not practicing social distancing. And that puts them in a very difficult situation where they go into a cell that's not clean, where social distancing is impossible, which puts them even more at risk of catching something and then spreading something when they go back. What about that? Is that an effective way to deal with the situation of people who aren't paying attention?
It's really not. And it's a last resort that, I'm known for criticizing the department when it gets things wrong, but this is, for the most part, it's been right. It's a last resort. Some people, like the businesses especially, if they we have to be able to enforce the shutdowns. If not, then no one's going to shut down because it's profits. In terms of taking individuals in, we're trying our best to not resort to that because it can be deadly.
Yeah, a lot of people are talking about should the police lay off on arresting around small crimes at this time? Because you're putting people into trouble, as well as, you know, should we be letting people out of Rikers because exposing them to a deadly virus becomes torture? You know, what do you think about that part?
The former or the latter?
Well, both of them.
Well, you know, to make an actual declaration that small crimes are not going to be enforced, I don't think that's the best way to go, to actually declare it. Obviously, officers have discretion. Given the situation, I would imagine that officers are going to use their discretion appropriately. In terms of inmates, the minute I started realizing this thing is a lot more serious than the president was making it seem, I realized that the prison system and the jail system, we're going to have to make some really tough decisions as to how we should go about it. For the low level things, I believe, it's an emergency. We can let those guys go, which should create the space to allow those who are convicted, of more serious crimes to be able to spread out enough to be for social distancing. The reality is, whether some people want to admit it or not, there are people who are genuinely a menace to society that sure. can be detrimental to the community if they're out and about. One thing that no media has reported, from what I've read, people are still getting shot in the street from street beef. Certain violent crimes are happening possibly at a higher rate because, unfortunately, there are people taking advantage of what's going on right now. The fact that it's okay to wear a mask, the fact that not too many people are going to be out to witness certain things. So we still, unfortunately, have to, have a grip on the crime while simultaneously trying to keep people healthy and safe.
Is crime in general, has it been, let's say, the last 2 to 3 weeks, this thing has become a hysteria that everybody's trying to pay attention to and deal with. Has crime in general stayed the same, gone up, gone down within that 2 to 3 week period?
In general, it's lower because people aren't out. But certain violent crimes, the numbers are, I would say, either the same or maybe even a little higher, particularly shootings. It's shocking to see the amount of shootings that are still going on. It makes no sense. No one's even supposed to be out.
That's crazy. Are you, how afraid are you for your safety? What about the average officer who may not be exactly like you, but similar, doing the same job? How afraid are officers that I know lots of thousands of officers are calling out sick. I'm sure many of them actually are sick. Many of them are reasonably afraid. What happens if I get, how afraid are you as an officer?
I mean, everyone's concerned, obviously, not just for ourselves, but especially with the information that you could be asymptomatic and carry this and give it to someone else. People don't want to bring this home to their older parents and grandparents, even their children. No one wants to care. No one wants to bring this to the people they love. No one wants to contract it themselves. No one wants to get unhealthy or die. So we're all concerned. I try to just protect myself. I already practice good hygiene. Now at this point, I just wear a mask and glove when on patrol. A mask at all times, gloves depending on what jobs I'm responding to. Obviously, unconscious person, I'm going to have my gloves on, etc. But everyone's concerned. Officers wish we could stay home. We wish we could, many officers said, I wish I wasn't essential at this point. But, we have to kind of, our job is to help keep society going at this point. So we report to work, despite thousands who have gone sick and are self-quarantining.
I mean, there must be an emotional impact on the force when something like a quarter of the force is saying that they are sick, thousands others are self-quarantining for whatever reason. So there's a diminished number of men and women who are actually able to do the job. What is the emotional impact on folks as they're fewer people are being asked to do more hours?
People, from speaking to colleagues, it's like any minute now, any minute now, we're going to get this thing. We probably already have it, you know. Mm. So it's been tough. It's been tough on my personnel and the rest of the force. But again, this is something that no one's really ever dealt with, you know. And so we're writing this thing as we go along, you know. We're trying to figure it out as we go along.
Sometimes you need stories that reflect the community, the culture, the world that you love. You can get some of that on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths, where you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and how to create world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is an account of what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective and diving into the things that we care about and the stories we want to hear that center Black perspectives. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes that celebrate the Black experience. Turn on NPR and listen to Black Stories, Black Truths, because Black stories make up what it means to be in America, and stories should never be told without us. Listen to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts. Great Expectations is a new novel from the New Yorker staff writer Vincent Cunningham, a keenly observed novel about a young Black man searching for his place in the world amidst a moment of historic change. Great Expectations is about the main character David's 18 months working for Senator Obama's 2008 presidential campaign. Along the way, David meets all sorts of people who raise questions about history, art, race, religion, and fatherhood that force David to look at his life in a new way and come to terms with his identity as a young Black man in America. Colin McCann says Great Expectations will be one of the most talked about novels of the year. And others have called this book epic, intimate, and brimming with brilliance. It got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, which is a big deal. And it's a coming-of-age story that takes you inside the Obama campaign like nothing else. Great Expectations is an extraordinary book, available wherever books are sold.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. There is a woman who went the distance, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor. I'm Katy Perry. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Elizabeth the First, the podcast, wherever you listen.
If you love Toure's show and you miss the days of me talking about politics on MSNBC, and really, who doesn't? Then check out my other podcast, Democracy-ish, where I sit with Danielle Moody Mills and argue and strategize about the 2020 race from a Black and progressive perspective.
I have seen many of meme talk about being a Cuomo-sexual. Did you not send me that? I have seen many of folks.
You can find Democracy-ish wherever podcasts are streamed. All right, back to Toure's show.
And your jurisdiction is in Brooklyn, right?
Correct.
And Brooklyn has Brooklyn and Queens have more positives than Manhattan and the other parts. I mean, like, Brooklyn and Queens are the hotspot of the hotspot New York City. It's really, yeah. You know. Mm-hmm. It's very, very difficult. I mean, you know, there's Brooklyn and Queens also are areas that a lot of people have talked about. Over-policing, and something that you have criticized in your work. But, you know, you wonder, what is the impact on Black and brown people when they live in neighborhoods that are consistently, historically, over-policed, and now the police are charged with not just stopping crime, but keeping people physically apart, right? And there's already a basic fear in a lot of people and a lot of officers in a congregation of Black people, especially young Black men. Like, what impact is that having?
It's it's been a strange experience because there are some people who stay inside, who understand what's going on. But the some of the younger folks, this is like a joke to them. They don't get it. So it causes avoidable interactions with officers. And, you know, I just wish people understood more. I mean, the cops, for the most part, they have been responding to crowds and groups for other reasons. So that it's not too different in that sense, although they're trying to keep themselves safe. And for the people in the street, to them, they just see it as them being harassed. They don't see this as something different. You know, they don't see it as any different than broken windows policing. You know, cops coming to bother us. You know, but that's been to a minimal. It hasn't been as bad as it could be, thankfully. But still, there are way too many people out that I wish were inside more.
I mean, for a lot of Black and brown people in the hood, staying in the house all day, especially in public housing where, you know, the space can often be quite small. There may be several people, multiple generations living in one small space. Staying in the house all day is nearly impossible, right?
It's tough. And, I know. Yeah.
Right. I mean, like, just talk about that. I mean, like, they sort of feel a need to be out and they're violating the guidelines, but it's very, very hard for them to just stay in the house all day long.
Even people with ample square footage, square feet at home, they're getting cabin fever. So you can imagine someone who, again, lives in a 2-bedroom apartment that has 10 people in there, multiple generations, kids, elderly. Outside is the escape from that. So they it's much more difficult for them to stay in. Because, there are people, they just go, home is where they shower and sleep, but they don't spend any time inside other than that because of the living situation. So it's tougher for some people, but we have to get this done. The quicker we get it done, the quicker we mitigate this thing, and the quicker we can start opening up our society. That's how people have to see it. They have to see the whole picture. Because if they are simply told to stay inside and don't understand that this is what leads to getting back to some as close to normal as possible. Because as we can imagine, that you know we're probably never going to go back to complete normal. If they see it that way, I think they might comply better. But I do empathize with those who don't have the best home situations, and outside is that escape.
It's crazy to think that we will never go back to complete normal, that those of us who are living through this will probably never forget it and will, you know, always, I mean, like, you know, Steve Kornacki on MSNBC the other day talked about his grandmother, right, going through the Depression, the Great Depression, and always having expectations and habits that were shaped by that. And I could easily see, you know, always not wanting to shake hands, you know, I'm going to fist bump everybody going forward, always wanting to make sure that I have a stack of money nearby, because who knows if, you know, because Corona 2 is going to happen, right? Like this strain was bad enough. There'll be another one, 5, 10, at some point down the road, this something similar will happen again, maybe even worse. What are the ways that you think that this will have a long-term or even permanent effect on people?
One of the things I've already been thinking about, I had no idea that a virus would come and exacerbate it and speed it up. Automation, it's going to take away a lot of jobs. And this situation is going to speed up automation in ways that we never saw coming. You know, self-checkout is a joke compared to what's coming. We already have trains that can run themselves. One of the things that's causing less trains is the fact that a lot of transit workers have called out. So in 10 years, that might not be the case because the computer might be running the whole show. So that's going to affect a lot of jobs. A lot of jobs. I mean, I remember Amazon was working on a drone years ago. The technology already exists. Cars already drive themselves. You know, that Amazon truck that does deliveries, it technically doesn't need a driver. That's one of the things that I think it's going to hit the hardest, people's jobs, because this is forcing companies to see just how far technology can be pushed to get the job done instead. People are learning that a lot of meetings don't have to happen in physical spaces. You know,
a lot of meetings don't have to happen.
Exactly. I don't even that. So that's one of the biggest changes that I see coming. In terms of the medical field, I'm hoping some of the good changes is we understand that certain things are essential for society to flow, and unfettered capitalism is not the way to go when it comes to certain things. You know, I get it. I understand that this is what this country was founded on, but we might have to, we have to make some changes when it comes to education, medical, you know, healthcare. We have to make changes that across the pond they realized decades ago. You know, I think we're going to be forced to have to make those changes.
Are there changes that you see in the future of policing that will stem from this situation, from this moment?
In terms of procedure, responding to unconscious people at home who have passed, I think a lot more precautions are going to be taken. I've seen right now detectives are putting on hazmat suits to go into those situations. That might become something more permanent. Other ways in which, honestly, laws might get passed so that if we ever have to order people to stay at home, there are more teeth and it's more enforceable, which, again, it is one of the things you want to avoid because of the way that a virus, you know, a science behind how a virus spreads. But yeah, those are the things I see changing in law enforcement.
When you go and just because when I read about what Ebola did to the body and the violent effect that Ebola had on the body, that it really took my understanding of what was going on with that situation to another level. Is there a different look to the dead corona body versus other diseases or other causes of death?
Not really from what I've seen, only because
we live in a world where you can get anything you need delivered to your door thanks to DoorDash. If you don't want to do the dishes or you feel a little sick, let DoorDash bring dinner tonight. My family uses DoorDash all the time because it connects us to our favorite restaurants without us having to drive. Last night, we got some Indian food for my wife, some gumbo for me, and sushi for the kids. And everyone was happy, and we didn't have to do the dishes. The process of ordering was quick and easy, and I love DoorDash for real. So I was so happy to do this for them because I'm a customer, because I know DoorDash is your door to more. Must be over 21 to order alcohol. Alcohol available only in select markets. DoorDash, your door to more. Download the DoorDash app now to get almost anything delivered. In my mind, the greatest author of the 20th century is Toni Morrison. And her greatest novel is Song of Solomon, a mesmerizing coming-of-age masterpiece that is gorgeously written and has captivated readers around the world. The protagonist, Milkman Dead, was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt to fly. For the rest of his life, Milkman is trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and find the place of his family's origin, she introduces an entire cast of strivers and liars and assassins and the inhabitants of an amazing, beautiful, fully realized black world. The New Yorker said Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personalities. Toni Morrison is a genius. She's one of the greatest writers of her time, of the century, and Song of Solomon is her greatest book, in my opinion. It's a must-read that will ignite your imagination and show you what the best possible fiction writing is like. And it's a timeless tale that will stay with you after you've turned its final page. When you get to the climax, you will feel it in your heart. Available now at tonimorrison.com
or wherever books are sold.
A lot of times the person dies, it's discovered in the morning when people realize, you know, uncle didn't wake up or where's mom. And a lot of times it's pretty fresh. And usually when it's fresh, you don't see much yet. There's, you know, rigor mortis takes a little longer to kick in. So I haven't witnessed that. I haven't witnessed anything that stands out, particularly. No.
I wonder what will be the impact of the amount of death that we are all about to experience. Because right now, as we talk, I believe the New York number or the national number is around 6,000 dead. And that's going up about 1,000 a day so far. And the national models are suggesting we could have 1 to 200,000 dead. And many of them happening in April and May. So that's a rapid increase in the number of people dying all the time in April and May. What is the massive number of folks dying? What is that doing to you and your brothers and sisters in blue? What impact is that having?
Yeah, I mean, it's affecting me. I'm not enjoying seeing this. One of the things that keeps me dedicated to the people is, you know, I take my job very personal, very serious. So when someone's grandmother or aunt or uncle or father or brother is dead in a room and the entire family is, you know, sitting in a semicircle in the living room crying, their eyeballs out, I feel it, you know. And again, this happened maybe once or twice a month. So many times. In such a short period of time, it starts to affect me. I'll be honest. At the time, there's a surrealism that goes on that allows you to stay professional and deal with it as a professional, but then you process it later. I think I'm going to have to get back to you to honestly answer that question as to just how much of a toll it takes. But I'm already feeling it. I've never seen so many dead people in such a short period of time.
Mm. And the number is only going to rise in the coming weeks.
Yeah.
Without obviously getting into names and specific identifying details, is there a story of that stands out for you that is particularly hard? We got a call, we had to go somewhere and somebody was already gone. From Corona, something that happened recently that sticks with you?
Yeah. The guy, unfortunately, found him stiff on his back. He had roommates who saw him laying on the floor and asked him, "Do you need an ambulance?" And he said, "He'll be fine." He said, "Just get me some water." He got him the water, and that was the last time they saw him alive. You know, and it's like, wow, you know, he had no idea his last moments were approaching. Yeah. And when we checked the seat, I think he spent the weekends with his grandchildren. They were like child seats in the back of his car.
Mm.
And it's just like, wow, that's it. This weekend, there will be no weekend with granddad this weekend. I mean, it shouldn't be because of the social distancing, but it will never be again. You know, and that's really stood out. It's unfortunate.
It's amazing how many stories have gone around and still a lot of people are not getting it.
You know, I've run into these conspiracies about 5G, you know, installation of 5G towers and film your hospital. And it's like, come on, man. You're in the comfort of your living room, you know, in the bleachers, and, you know, having no idea what people on the front lines are going through. And this becomes just something to, you know, it's to me, it's disrespectful, you know.
You scared to go to work?
No. My dedication to the people, I've already made the decision. In terms of criminal justice reform, though, I already made the decision that the people are worth it. This is different. I never saw something like this coming. But again, the call of duty, it suppresses all of those emotions, and you just focus on getting the job done, you know? And to me, it's a blessing to be able to be out there in the community that I work in now. People recognize me, and then they'll come up to me and say, I've never cared to approach a cop and tell them I'm proud of them or I appreciate them, but I know who you are, and thank you for what you're doing for us. Thank you for what you've done for us. We feel the difference, you know? So that's motivation right there.
I mean, you in particular have gone out of your way to be critical of the department in many ways, and to be somebody who is trying to make the police force better, you know. And what blowback has that had for you? Because officers don't necessarily want somebody going around policing the department and trying to make them, follow all the laws and all the rules and be the best officer they can be. You know, I mean, the corners get cut, people, you know, and I think people get spoiled perhaps or ruined in a way by the job, right? Because you're constantly coming up against the worst of humanity, people acting their worst or having gone through their worst moments. I imagine the cynicism rise up pretty high. The sense that humanity is nothing rides up pretty high. So what has been the impact on you for as you're trying to police or improve the department?
It's been a combination. It's three. It's some people are just completely ignorant to who I am and what I'm doing. They just come into work, you know, then worry about making sure the check clears every two. As long as the check clears every 2 weeks, they're good to go. Then there's been those who, you know, they hate me. I don't know. There's no other word for it. They see me. I'm an eyesore. The fact that I'm a supervisor. I'm the supervisor now. And I've been so outspoken. They don't understand why I haven't been crushed. They don't understand why I'm on the job. They see me as anti-police. And they're like, if you're anti-police, why are you on the job? And even though I'm speaking to create a better police department for them to be in, they just can't see it that way. They're unable to separate themselves as individuals from the department as an entity. So when the department gets criticized, they take it very personal. You know, it's as if I'm criticizing them individually, which is insane because that's just not the case. But then there are those who, sometimes with tears in their eyes, share their own personal stories of what they went through because of enforcement quotas and having to target Black and brown folks, and how thankful they are that things have gotten a lot better, a lot better. The numbers game is not what it used to be. And they know that it's because of the NYPD 12, you know, the efforts of myself and the others who decided to speak out. So that's been the three: people who are ignorant, people who absolutely can't stand the fact that I exist, and people who are very grateful for what I've done.
Thanks so much to Lieutenant Raymond for an epic interview. And thanks to you for listening. And thanks to our super producers, Britt, Jerry Michael Smith, Marcus Harkis, Noel, Sam Montes, and Jason Reynolds. Join us over at patreon.com/Torre Show for more from Lieutenant Raymond. Get an extra episode every Friday only for Patreon subscribers. Torre Show gives you fuel to power your dreams because you can use your dreams like a rocket ship to blast you into a life you never imagined. You can make your dreams a reality, and this show can help. You can find me on Twitter at Torre and on Instagram at Torre Show and on Patreon at patreon.com/Torre Show. Torre Show is written by me, Torre, and produced by Jackie Garofano. Our editor is Ryan Woodhull. Our photographers are Chuck Marcus and Shanta Covington. Our booker is Claudia Jean. And we're distributed by DCP Entertainment. And we will be back on Friday and on Wednesday with more amazing guests because the man can't shut us down.